Clayton English.
I'm Greg Lott.
And this is season two of the War on Drugs podcast. Sure.
Last year, a lot of the problems of the drug war. This year, a lot of the biggest names in music and sports.
This is kind of star-studded a little bit, man.
We met them at their homes. We met them at their recording studios. Stories matter, and it brings a face to
it. It makes it real.
It really does. It makes it real.
Listen to new episodes of the War on Drugs podcast season two on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Brendan Patrick Hughes, host of Divine Intervention. This is a story about radical nuns in combat boots and wild-haired priests trading blows with J. Edgar Hoover in a hell-bent effort to sabotage a war.
J. Edgar Hoover was furious. He was out of his mind, and he wanted to bring the Catholic left to its knees.
Listen to Divine Intervention on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm ready to fight. Oh, this is fighting words. Okay, I'll put the hammer back.
Hi, I'm George M. Johnson, a best-selling author with the second most banned book in America. Now more than ever, we need to use our voices to fight back.
Part of the power of Black queer creativity is the fact that we got us, you know?
We are the greatest culture makers in world history.
Listen to Fighting Words on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On November 21st, 1997, a Suffolk County, Virginia man known for drug dealing and gambling named Gene Artis and his sister Yvonne Giles were both fatally shot in front of Yvonne's six-year-old son, Trayvon. The boy was discovered in his blood-soaked t-shirt and underwear outside of the house shortly after the shooting, around 10 p.m. Trayvon gave a very descriptive police report, but later became unable to remember the details of the tragic event in a court of law. However, Gene Artis' girlfriend and several other associates began making police statements that named another man involved in the drug trade, Lorico Kearney, collectively saying that he shot Gene to recover a large gambling loss. Shortly before his trial, another drug dealer claimed that Lorico had plotted to rob Gene Artis of the gambling score in order to repay him for a drug debt. Lorico was convicted, but a constitutional violation triggered a new trial in which three new witnesses joined the Commonwealth's case. With this many people willing to testify, revealing the statements of the only person who actually saw the murders wouldn't even have seemed like it was necessary. But this is wrongful conviction. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. Today we have another case out of Virginia, which again, the entire substance of the state's case was built upon the words of incentivized witnesses receiving leniency on their own charges, by the way, all while ignoring the only actual credible witness and the most likely suspect. Meanwhile, the man who they focused on instead is calling in today, over 25 long years later, from Greensville Correctional Facility in Virginia. Lorico Kearney, I'm sorry you're with us today under the circumstances, but all of us here at Wrongful Conviction are happy and honored that you're joining us today.
Thank y'all just for giving me this opportunity, you know, to share my story.
Yeah, you're most welcome. And also joining us, and you'll remember him from our coverage of Terrence Hobbs, is Lenny Singleton, who did his own stint, a legal conviction, but a crazy sentence of 1,310 years for having stolen a little over $500. No one was hurt and no weapon was used. Lenny was a jailhouse lawyer and then benefited from a conditional pardon and soon joined the Coggeshall law firm from which he and his wife Vandy crusade for the wrongfully convicted. So, Lenny, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
I think our audience will agree that this is very similar to Terrence Hobbs's case. Not the story itself, but the patterns of the investigation and the misconduct and the prosecution. The towns in which they occurred were less than 20 miles apart, by the way, where, as I alluded to in the opening, you have a crime that occurred in the drug culture of the 90s and an investigation that bent over backwards to ignore the most likely suspect, turning instead to incentivized and or coerced witness testimony in exchange for sentence reductions and things like that. The similarities of the cases are striking, from which it's easy to see that there's patterns here, right? We see these all over the country, but it seems like there's a cluster of them in Virginia.
I don't know that we could just focus on Virginia. I think this is a widespread issue where snitches, and most of them do this for a living, they're always in trouble, and they know how to work the system. They know who to call. They know who to get in contact with. I've seen several cases in Virginia where guys will see someone on TV, on the news, call someone and say, look, I'm in the pub with this guy, and I overheard him saying this, that, and the other, when in fact those things have never happened. But it is a culture in Virginia that needs to be stopped for sure, because I've never seen one that actually was true. They're always working to get a deal, get a time cut, as you could clearly see in the letters that Larico's attorney was able to obtain, these inmates writing folk, telling them, I'll say whatever you need me to say, just let me get this certain deal.
Yeah, and we'll quote from those letters later. It's really egregious. And of course, again, this doesn't only happen in Virginia. It happens in all 50 states, but some states have even enacted laws in order to only allow this kind of testimony if it's corroborated by some physical evidence, of which there usually is none. And this case is no exception. But before we get into all of that, Larico, you grew up in kind of like in two different places, mostly with your mom in Surrey, Virginia, and then part of the time with your father and your grandparents in Suffolk, Virginia. Is that right?
I'm originally from Suffolk, Virginia. My mom was a single parent. You know, my dad, you know, he was, you know, in and out of the streets. You know, he was in and out of jail. My mother's job carried her from different places. So I moved from Suffolk to Windsor, and eventually I moved to Surrey County. But I was still, you know, visiting my grandmother and my father on the weekends. And like I said, you know, my father, you know, he sold drugs. And me watching my father, you know, you see the so-called drug dealers, they're wearing nice clothes, driving nice cars. And, you know, I thought that was cool.
And this is something I've heard before. What a young person growing up around that scene quickly notices that everyone who's not selling drugs is struggling to get by, while the ones who are involved in the trade have seemingly comfortable lives.
And money in your pocket. Yeah, back in those days, seriously.
Yeah.
You know, when crack cocaine hit, yeah, they were the heroes in the neighborhood, actually, sadly.
And the only ones with any real economic power until, of course, they got caught and sent away for some ungodly sentence like Larico's father.
But my father went to prison in 1995. He had 54 years under the old law with parole. He was denied a couple of times. He ended up doing 16 years and 4 months.
And what did life look like for you after he went away? I understand you had moved out of your mom's and in with your father and your grandparents.
It's just me, my grandmother, or my grandfather. I'm indulging in the streets. There's nothing, you know, to glorify, you know, be proud of, but I was in, you know, buying and selling drugs.
Right. So you were probably already on the radar of local law enforcement, but had you ever been arrested before?
I was arrested in October of 97. I had a possession of cocaine, assault on an officer, and other traffic violations that came with that same incident 1 month before this happened.
Whoa. Back up a second there, though. Assault of a police officer? What happened in that case?
I think in the process of them restraining me, I think he may have hurt his finger.
Oh, Jesus Christ. I mean, so, since the arrest was the impetus for the officer's injury, they, of course, you know, some sort of sinister gaslighting move, they got to charge you with assault of an officer, which makes you sound like a super violent person, when in actuality, he had injured himself.
Yes, sir.
And so now with this arrest and the alleged assault, and I'm putting that in quotation marks, of a police officer just a month before the murders, from what I understand, this put you on house arrest with an ankle monitor with only supervised outings. So needless to say, you're a well-known entity to the local police. You were ripe for the picking, so to speak, right? You were an easy fall guy for them. And one of the deceased in this case was also known to both you and the police, which is the guy named David Eugene Artis, who went by Gene. What was your relationship to Gene?
We were running to each other on a regular basis. You know, like I said, he was a drug dealer in the area, and Gene would, you know, always, you know, look to entice people to gamble, to shoot dice, because he was good at it. I guess that's how he supported himself, you know, gambling and selling drugs.
And it was part of the state's theory that he had enticed you into a few games in which you had lost big money. Did you used to gamble with Gene?
I never personally gambled with Gene because I knew how good Gene was.
Yeah, some of those guys, man, they come up with these techniques. There's a way you can actually set the dice and increase the probability of a certain number. Gene probably was good with dice. He knew how to set them. He knew how to increase his chances at winning.
So you knew better than to play with Gene. Had your father been the one who gave you that advice?
He actually did on, you know, more than one occasion. He actually did.
You had even turned him down in front of two individuals who eventually were coerced into testifying against you. I'm talking about Casey Davis and Travis Chalk.
The morning that Gene Artis was killed, he came to the house trying to entice us to gamble. Of course, all of us said no.
Right, but the authorities eventually coerced those two men into making false statements about you, saying that you were in possession of a black 45 caliber firearm the day before, and then the morning of the 21st that you had said, quote, if he don't have a G or better, I'm going to kill him because I'm tired of him winning my money and coming with no money, end quote. Chalk went on to say that you and Gene shot dice for about an hour and then agreed to pause the game and pick it up later. The authorities were also successful in getting Gene's girlfriend at the time to say that you had once lost something like $5,000 to Gene in a dice game, but that also had never happened?
His girlfriend at the time, her name was Sabrina Norfleet. I think that she had some charges pending, or she had a situation going on. You know, that's why she fabricated a story, which never happened. Seeing me gamble with Gene in a place that, as God is my witness, I had never in my life been to.
But there was something that she testified to that was true, which was seeing you and Gene together earlier on in the night that he was murdered, when she pulled up to Gene in a gas station and you had asked him for a ride home.
I was at the sub shop that was across the street from the gas station that Gene Artis was at. I asked her for a ride, and she had pulled up in that gas station too. I guess her and Gene, they had an argument, but she did see me sitting in the car with Gene. He was just giving me a ride home.
So he dropped you off at your grandparents. You later walked down the street to be with one of your kids at the child's mother's house. Both the child's mother and grandmother later testified to your whereabouts during the murders of Gene Artis and his sister, Yvonne Giles, which was November 21st, 1997. They were both shot while at home sometime between 9 and 10 p.m., and apparently there was a pizza delivery before the murders. The pizza delivery person, Teresa Ricks, saw two men arguing on their way into the residence at 116 Franklin Street, neither of which she recognized as you, Rico. So there was another witness to this entire harrowing seen this whole ordeal.
There was one person who was there and who actually saw the killer, 6-year-old Trayvon Artis, who lived in the apartment with his mother and his uncle. At about 10 p.m. the night of November 21st, 97, Trayvon was found standing outside of that 116 Franklin Street address wearing nothing but a shirt and his underwear with his mother's blood on his clothes, and he led a neighbor to the bodies in the apartment.
Okay, first let's take a second to recognize that this is a frightened little boy in a terrifying situation. Now, the neighbor that took him back inside was his mother's boyfriend, Jody Cross, and by now the police had been called.
Trayvon gave a statement to the police at 11 p.m., so this wasn't long after, in which he stated clearly and unequivocally that a relative of his named Gregory Artis, not Larico, had been in the apartment and had shot and killed his mother, Yvonne Giles, right in front of him. He repeated these statements to the police twice more the next day.
And he's crystal clear with the police about what happened. Can you read some of the report for us?
They questioned, "Did you see the man that shot your mom?" He said, "Yes." And they asked him, "Is his name Jody Cross?" He says, "No, that's my mom's boyfriend." "Did Gregory Artis shoot your mom?" "Yes." "Did you see Gregory Artis shoot your mom?" "Yes." "How do you know Gregory Artis?" "He has been to my house before and played cards with my uncle." Trayvon gives the police details. He says, "I've spent time at his house. His kids and I play together." He knows this guy. So they ask him, "Tell me in your own words what you know about this offense." And I guess this is the next day. He says, "Trayvon Artis advised he was in his mom's bedroom with her watching TV when he heard David and Gregory Artis arguing. They were arguing over a card game. Gregory said that David was cheating."
Again, Gene's full name is David Eugene Artis. So the name David and Gene refer to the same man.
He says that Gene had a small silver gun and that Gregory had a big black gun, that Gene shot Gregory and Gregory shot at Gene. Him and his mom went into Trayvon's closet to hide. When no more shots were fired, him and his mom got out of the closet and went down the hall. He followed his mom. Once they were in the front foyer, Gregory and David were standing there, and two more shots were fired, and he fell dead on the floor. Gregory then walked up to me and my mom, and he was told by Gregory, "I'm going to shoot and kill your mom now. And remember, Gregory Artis killed your mom, and that's when he shot her," this says, "in the neck area, and she fell on the floor by the window, and he shot her again." Gregory then left out the house. And then they ask him to describe Gregory Artis, and he describes him to the T. He says that Gregory Artis was a black male, darker skinned, with two birthmarks or moles on each side of his forehead and white freckles. He's about 50 years old. Gregory lives in North Carolina in a two-story house and lives with his mom.
It's just awful for this little kid. And then the authorities appear to have completely ignored him, except for the description of the murder weapon, a big black gun, which they knew to be a .45 from the fragments they pulled from his mother's skull. Now, $700 in cash was also found at the scene, I believe $550 of which was in Gene Artis' pocket, in addition to some drugs. So the idea that this was a robbery sprung on by dice game losses to a fellow drug dealer is absurd. But instead of just going to North Carolina and arresting Gregory Artis, Detective E.C. Harris appears to use Gene's involvement in drugs as an opportunity to target other guys in that business, including yourself, for either a wrongful conviction or a false statement to use in a wrongful conviction. And as we mentioned, you were on house arrest at the time for that cocaine possession and the bogus assault charge when they came to see you. And you had been seen with Gene at the gas station that night, so your name was floating around in the rumor mill, so to speak.
So I guess, you know, my name was in this rumor mill, and they realized that I was on house arrest. They gave me a violation because I was actually out of my house, you know, that weekend that this crime happened. So I was taken to jail, and I guess the prosecutors or whoever had planted me in the cell with an informant. His name was Brad Parker, and he tried to question me about these homicides, and I explained to the gentleman, like, no, that's not what I'm locked up for. The following week, I was given a bond, so I was out again. Later on, he ended up writing to the prosecutors or whatever and telling them that I admitted to him while I was in that cell about committing these crimes. So I think all investigations, everything stemmed from that.
And he wasn't the only one willing to offer false statements against you and your co-defendant, Quentin Parrish, a.k.a. QP. Eventually, a laundry list of people was compiled, including Casey Davis, Travis Chalk, Sabrina Norfleet, as well as two other guys, Tony Booth and Willie Hardy. But was this statement from Brad Parker how they originally obtained your arrest warrant?
No, it wasn't Brad Parker. They had got a statement from a Willie Hardy stating that I made a last confession to him about committing these murders. He was a suspect in this crime, him and my co-defendant, Quentin Parrish.
So it turned out that he and Quentin Parrish were childhood buddies who grew up on the same block, but Quentin refused to give false statements, unlike Willie Hardy. So you were arrested on December 28, 1997, and your family hired an attorney named Ken Melvin, who was very effective. Now, Hardy testified to this false statement at a preliminary hearing in June of 98, but ended up catching his own charges and hired William P. Robinson, the same attorney as his buddy Quentin Parrish, your co-defendant. Hardy admitted to his attorney, Robinson, that he had given false testimony against you, and your attorney, Ken Melvin, was present.
They recorded this conversation where he admitted to lying about Lorico Kearney. Willie Hardy said he had been threatened and harassed by detectives every day, threatening to charge him with the crimes for which Kearney is incarcerated.
So now, with this recording, your attorney filed a motion for dismissal of all charges against you, and eventually there was a hearing. Meanwhile, the prosecution was scrambling to find a new star witness, and they found another guy from the Suffolk drug game, Tony Booth.
I ran into him one time in the Western Tidewater region of jail. Well, we was on the basketball court in the jail. He had hired Kenny Mel, and he asked me about how Kenny Mel was doing on my case. And I was like, yeah, he's doing a good job. Maybe a couple of days later, he was transferred from the Western Tidewater region of jail to Chesapeake. That's when I later learned, you know, that, you know, he had hopped on my case.
Right. So he hired Ken Melvin for his own charges. And then, using this conversation on the yard as a pretext for an alleged confession, began working with the state as a witness in your case, presenting Ken Melvin with a conflict of interest. And now this attorney, who had been super effective thus far, was likely to be forced to drop you as a client. All this may or may not have been engineered by the prosecution. Smells like an onion, might be an onion, but
For now, let's get back to the hearing to dismiss your charges based on the recording which Willie Hardy admitted to perjuring himself at your preliminary hearing. What happened when they got him on the stand?
Fearing he would be charged with perjury, he said he'd been through a lot and he'd been shot, so he couldn't remember anything now.
Judge Westbrook Parker said it's a possibility that before Mr. Kearney's trial comes up, he may regain his memory back.
And so this Judge Westbrook Parker ruled that Kearney's indictment would not be dismissed because the witness did not recant, even though they had a recording that he said he was lying about it.
So now on this day, the prosecutor put in a motion to have Mr. Melvin disqualified from my case because they now have another witness, which was Tony Booth.
In 2020, a group of young women in a tidy suburb of New York City found themselves in an AI-fueled nightmare.
Someone was posting photos.
It was just me naked. Well, not me, but me with someone else's body parts on my body parts that looked exactly like my own.
I wanted to throw up. I wanted to scream.
It happened in Levittown, New York.
But reporting the series took us through the darkest corners of the internet and to the front lines of a global battle against deepfake pornography.
This should be illegal, but what is this?
This is a story about a technology that's moving faster than the law and about vigilantes trying to stem the tide. I'm Margie Murphy.
And I'm Olivia Carvel.
This is Levittown, a new podcast from iHeart Podcasts, Bloomberg and Kaleidoscope.
Listen to Levittown on Bloomberg's Big Take podcast. Find it on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In 1978, Roger Caron's first book was published, and he was unlike any first-time author Canada had ever seen.
Roger Caron was 16 when first convicted.
Has spent 24 of those years in jail.
12 years in solitary.
He went from an ex-con to a literary darling almost overnight.
He was instantly a celebrity.
He was an adrenaline junkie, and he was the star of the show.
Go Boy is the gritty true story of how one man fought his way out of some of the darkest places imaginable.
I had a knife go in my stomach, puncture my spleen, break my ribs. I had my guts all in my hands.
Only to find himself back where he started.
Roger's saying is, I've never hurt anybody but myself. And I said, oh, you're so wrong. You're so wrong on that one, Rob.
From Campside Media and iHeart Podcasts, listen to Go Boy on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, hello, Malcolm Gladwell here. On this season of Revisionist History, we're going where no podcast has ever gone before. In combination with my three-year-old, we defend the show that everyone else hates. I'm talking, of course, about Paw Patrol.
There's some things that really piss me off when it comes to Paw Patrol.
It's pretty simple. It sucks.
My son watches Paw Patrol. I hate it.
Everyone hates it, except for me. Plus, we investigate everything from why American sirens are so unbearably loud, to the impact of face blindness on social connection, to the secret behind Thomas's English muffins, perfect nooks and crannies, and also, we go after Joe Rogan. Are you ready, Joe? I'm coming for you. You won't want to miss it. Listen to Revisionist History on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mr. Melvin was disqualified off my case. It was strategic. You know, I guess they felt as though with the case that they had, it would have been hard for them to get a conviction on me had I had Kenneth Melvin as my attorney.
So that was September of 99. And as your first trial was fast approaching, your co-defendant, Quentin Parrish, probably seeing what you both were up against, decided to take an Alford plea to avoid a potential life sentence.
And that's how they get a lot of guys, too. They scare them. With that, I could see him very easily pleading out, even though he had nothing to do with it, just because he was afraid he would never get out.
But Larico, you weren't backing down, even though you were facing a similar fate.
Yeah, I had 2 counts of capital murder and 2 counts of use of a firearm.
So the state's theory of this crime was circumstantial evidence of Rico's alleged rift with Gene Artis over some gambling debt.
Now, Larico tells us that this whole disagreement over gambling between he and Gene was impossible because he knew better than to play dice with a guy that was a real hustler, right? Gene was that guy. And he didn't want to lose his money. But the state fabricated statements to the contrary from Sabrina Norfleet, Travis Chalk, and Casey Davis.
Sabrina Norfleet gave false testimony witnessing Gene win $5,000 from me around September of that year. So that, you know, provided a false motive for them. Travis Chalk gave a testimony that he was at, you know, my house before these murders happened. He said when Gene pulled up, I made a statement to him, if Gene didn't have $1,000 or better, I would kill him because I'm tired of Gene winning my money and coming with no money. And we went in the house to gamble. And the gentleman that was in the driveway with him at the time, whose name is Casey Davis, he testified to seeing me with the .45 caliber firearm on November 20th.
A firearms identification expert testified that the .45 caliber bullet killed Miss Giles. They're saying that they were fired from the same weapon. And some cartridge casings were found, both of a .45 and a .380 caliber.
Right. No bullets or fragments were found in Gene, but two different casings likely came from the exchange between Gene and Gregory Artis. So they've fabricated the motive and the means, and now they place you with Gene, which is actually something that was true. Sabrina Norfleet saw you two guys together at the gas station that night.
Yeah, she seen us together. At the East Coast gas station, she was playing to him about the argument. And, you know, she told him that I was the last person, you know, seen with Gene Artis. And my thing is this, you know, y'all charged me with another individual. So where did it come in that y'all linked me with Mr. Parrish? And she's telling y'all it was just me and Gene together.
Right. Part of the state's evidence was this Mr. Travis Chalk, who said that he had seen Gene driving alone in a white Chevy, and that Larico and Quentin Parrish, known as QP, they were in a white Mitsubishi Gallant heading towards Franklin Street following him.
So he was supposed to be in Gene's car, but now he's in a different car with another guy following Gene. Which way is it, guys? I mean, you can't have it both ways.
Travis Trout, several years later, gave an affidavit that all of it was a lie. In fact, I do have that affidavit. Travis Chalk said, I never saw Larico Kearney with a gun, nor did he say anything about killing anyone over some gambling debts, as stated to me by Detective E.C. Harris. He says that that detective led me to say I saw Larico Kearney with the type of gun that was used in the murders, and that he harassed me almost daily, and that he came with papers to encourage me to sign, threatening me with incarceration if I did not cooperate. Travis Chalk said I was young and afraid, and I was given paperwork as to what to say in court by Detective E.C. Harris.
Obviously, the jury didn't benefit from this knowledge, just as they had not benefited from Willie Hardy's admissions from the preliminary hearing. And then the Commonwealth brought in another steaming pile of conflicting testimony from Tony Booth. Now the motive isn't just about being mad about losing $5,000 to Gene. Now it was $5,000 that he needed to pay Mr. Booth for drugs.
Tony Booth said that I sold drugs for him. I owed him money and I told him that, you know, I had to kill some people to get the money back. I lost the money gambling. And the testimony that he gave, it didn't match the evidence. He just said, I held the guns to the people's head while PC, he said PC, and my co-defendant's name was QP, and he was saying PC, and PC searched their pockets for money and drugs, you know, while I held the guns to him and killed him after that. You know, Gene Artis, he had crack cocaine and $550 in cash in his pocket at the time of his death. So the testimony that Tony Booth gave, it didn't even match the evidence.
Right. If you had robbed Gene to pay Tony, as he alleged, then Gene's pockets would not have been full of money and drugs. You don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to figure this out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Booth was awaiting sentencing for his own charges, which was a projected 280 months, a little over 23 years. And that sentencing was suspended until he fulfilled his obligation at your first and second trials. Tony Booth, you guessed it, ended up serving only 5 years. Now, Larico's public defender, courtesy of Tony Booth, mind you, Michael Rosenberg, poked holes in Booth's story and his credibility on cross-examination. That's good, but what else was presented in your favor?
The defense called an attorney, you know, to get on the stand to explain to the jury about the plea bargain that Tony Booth had entered into, you know, about him, you know, looking for a sentence reduction.
Also a witness, Teresa Ricks, testified she was a pizza delivery person who had delivered a pizza to 116 Franklin Street in the hours before the murders. And she did see two black men, one heavy set, one medium build, enter the house after arguing with each other, getting out of their car. And this Miss Ricks testified that neither of these men were Lorico Kearney, who she knew from school. They went to school together.
My son's mother and her mother, they actually testified on my behalf too, saying that, you know, I was there in my baby mother's house, you know, at the time that this alleged offense had happened. My aunt, she actually testified on my behalf too. You know, she told the jury that, you know, she was in the driveway when I came from my baby mother's house.
Unfortunately, loved ones don't make convincing alibi witnesses, as they're easily explained away as someone who might be willing to lie. But his attorney was in possession of the statement from the only witness who should have mattered, which was Trayvon. And Trayvon was who pointed the finger directly at Gregory Artis. Yet this alternate and much more likely suspect was never presented to the jury, among so much more.
The fact that his lawyer didn't bring up any physical evidence and none of it pointed to Lorico was just astounding to me. They took fingerprints from the crime scene, and to this day, they haven't tried to match those fingerprints to anyone except Lorico Kearney.
I mean, what about Gregory Artis? Apparently, no one was interested enough, so the jury came to a predictable conclusion.
I mean, I didn't have any idea that I could be actually convicted of that crime. You know, I had high hopes. Like I said, I was going home, my family in the courtroom. I didn't think there was any way that they could find me guilty. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I was in shock. Like, I was numb. I kind of felt like, you know, I let everybody down, even though it was beyond my control.
And your verdict at the first trial was really odd. You were found guilty of first-degree murder, but only of Yvonne Giles, along with the related firearm charge.
You know, because you had Casey Davis testifying, he seen me with the .45 caliber weapon. I guess they said that, you know, the .45 caliber fragment of a bullet was found in the skull. It was a compromised verdict.
Right. .45 caliber bullet fragments were only pulled from Yvonne Giles' skull, and maybe they weren't totally convinced of your guilt, so they acquitted you for the murder of Gene Artis. Cold comfort there, but you were still sentenced to life for the Yvonne Giles homicide, plus 3 years for the gun charge. But your public defender, a new one who you had been assigned, Joseph Winston, was actually able to appeal this verdict and win. Since the only person who could contradict Tony Booth was you, and the Commonwealth's attorney unconstitutionally argued to the jury that you should have testified, this constituted a clear violation of your Fifth Amendment rights. So they properly declared it a mistrial.
I was convicted in February of 2000. My case was overturned January 29th, 2002. I hadn't been in prison at that time, but 15 months. But I had been around guys that had actually been down 20 or 25 years. You know, I finally get that paperwork saying that my case was overturned, and I shared that with a few individuals. And, you know, like, some people were happy for me. Like, you know, we've been waiting, like, to get paperwork like this for 20-plus years. And they was basically telling me, though, take advantage of the opportunity. And when I did go back to court, they offered me a plea bargain.
They just convicted you, but now they're offering you a plea. That kind of feels like they had a little bit of a guilty conscience, maybe. Like, they knew this conviction was bullshit. So now Joseph Winston was off your case, you were transferred to jail, and a new public defender named Dwayne Struthers was assigned to your case.
You know, he came to see me and asked me would I be interested in taking a plea deal. You know, I told him no, unless it be time served, you know, because, you know, I mean, I didn't do this. That's what I'm explaining to him. He asked me where if they would offer 10 years to serve, would you be interested in that? And at the time, I had been incarcerated a little bit over 5 years. And I said, would this 5 years that I already did be included with this 10? And he didn't know.
So without a potential 5-year deal or time served, you were ready for a second chance to fight for your innocence in court. And that meant the state got a second chance, too. So you were initially in protective custody, or the PC pod as it's known, and then you got transferred into the general population where you made some new acquaintances, notably Ronald Brookins and Raymond Copeland.
They tried to, you know, befriend me. So I had been in there with them maybe a couple of months, and all of a sudden they put me back in this protective custody pod, and Brookins and Copeland came to visit. And, you know, they enticed them to lie. And I know you've read them. I've got the letters that they wrote to the prosecutor and to Detective E.C. Harris about the meeting that they had.
So Mr. Brookins says to the Commonwealth attorney, Mr. Jameson, hello, Mr. Jameson. I'm hoping to find you and yours in the best of health. Highest of spirits.
The highest of spirits.
And it's a crazy shit. I'm writing you in concern of the visit received from you today. I feel as if we did not reach a very clear understanding about having my Jeep returned and the charges dropped. Now I'm waiting on an appeal. This you could stop. Just have the federal courts to withdraw their appeal and drop the case. I have never had a violent charge, so this should not be hard. I have gave my life to the Lord, and I'm willing to help you as best as I can. If I'm going to take the stand, I need to know my charges are being dropped. I just want a chance to start my newfound life in Christ over on the outside. If you give me another chance, I will not let you down.
Sincerely yours in Christ. While I put my hand on the Bible, swear to tell the truth, and then lie my ass off to help the state ruin another man's life, just like Jesus would do. I mean, apparently Mr. Brookins pretended to be a friend of Larico's father, and then he took a look at Larico's transcripts, all in this twisted attempt to concoct a believable alleged confession in exchange for his own charges being dropped and the return of his Jeep. And then along comes Mr. Brookins' cellmate, or blockmate, Raymond Copeland.
Raymond Copeland, he was sentenced to 10 years. And the letter that he wrote to the prosecutor, he was seeking to have his 10-year sentence cut to 3, you know, for his testimony, and basically saying he can be as convincing and moving as possible to help bury me. And also that he had testified in another murder case for this prosecutor before.
Right. So this is a trial-tested bullshit artist. So Lenny, please read from the letter Mr. Copeland wrote about the meeting he had with a Commonwealth's attorney just 6 days before his own proceedings.
Raymond Copeland. He says, I am writing in concern about our last meeting, which took place on January 28, 2003, where you mentioned not making any promises, and I can respect that. But perhaps we need to discuss my situation more clearly. I am participating in a double murder trial. I know others are involved that have a lot more time and more serious crimes than I do. So I want you to know I'm not trying to wait until I get to prison before my requests are granted. I was sentenced by Westbrook Parker, which you may be familiar with. I know from experience, if you can talk with Mr. Parker, who's the judge, I can get everything I've asked for because I'm not asking for much. I can't go to any prison because of possible retaliation for my testimony. Now, before I take the witness stand, all I'm asking is your word off the record. Please contact me and let me rehearse my testimony. And also, I need to evaluate my situation as far as how I will be rewarded.
Rehearse my testimony?
Rehearse my testimony.
There was also a third jailhouse snitch, Christopher Joyner, but we were unable to obtain any damning letters from him. However, in Virginia, there's no parole, and Joyner's 54-year sentence appears to have magically disappeared, as he was released, in fact, years ago. He alleged that he overheard incriminating statements from Larico while he was on the phone. So now that everyone was well rehearsed, you went back to trial in February 2003. There was still no physical evidence tying Larico to the scene. Fingerprints that they believed would be probative just didn't match Larico Kearney. Sabrina Norfleet, Travis Chalk, Casey Davis, and Tony Booth returned. So this much was exactly the same, minus the Fifth Amendment violation, and now there were three new lying jailhouse snitches. And in addition to their sentence reductions and letters to the Commonwealth Attorney, there were even more reasons to find their testimonies totally unreliable.
Brooke has testified that I said I kicked the door in, and that was known throughout the trial. Like, whoever had committed this crime, it was no forced entry. They knew the victims. Struthers, he did point that out, and the prosecutor, you know, just made up some bogus theory like showed them a picture of a door in the back of the apartment. Like, look at that door. Don't it look like somebody was trying to get out that door?
So clearly, Brookins misunderstood the facts that he was supposed to regurgitate for the state. But what about Copeland?
Copeland's testimony was basically the same because they was in the same block. And of course, they got together to, you know, to go over what they would say.
Including the same mistakes that proved they didn't know what the fuck they were talking about. Now, Christopher Joyner, he was in the protective custody pod with you because he was also cooperating on a number of other cases, which does not bode well for his credibility either. And he alleged overhearing you say incriminating things while on the phone. Now, you had taken a phone call while he was in earshot one day when you had returned from a motion hearing in which you found out that Brookins and Copeland were going to testify against you.
My trial was to start that Monday, and I found out that Friday. So, you know, I came back, I used the phone, I called my stepfather, explaining to him, you know, what had happened in court. And everything that, you know, he heard me say on the phone to my stepfather, he wrote it down and put his own little twist and spin on it. He actually testified that I confessed to Brookins and Copeland about, you know, me doing the murder. I was bragging or saying that I was like an O.J. Simpson. It's just some bogus stuff he was saying that didn't even make sense.
And like we mentioned, he too received a sentence reduction for his O.J. Simpson references. Now, the defense called the alibi witnesses again, your loved ones, as well as the pizza delivery person, in addition to other people who Copeland and Brookins had previously testified about. But the difference with this trial was Trayvon, who is now 11 years old, because 5 years had gone by. You called him to the stand to get him to recount what he had already said in his statements to police, which was that Gregory Artis had murdered Gene Artis and Yvonne Giles right in front of him. Alone.
I tried to call him as my witness at the second trial, and I'm trying to get him to testify to what he said, or at least get the statement presented to the jury. And, you know, they excused the jury, and they did what you call a proffer. And they placed him on the stand. He just said he didn't remember anything. You know, they showed him the statement, and he, like, I guess he may have been coached, but he just said he couldn't remember. And the judge said that I couldn't get the statement in to the jury because I couldn't impeach my own witness. So they didn't allow the statement to get into the jury.
And once again, the jury did not hear the most important witness statement, the one taken from the only eyewitness to the crime just moments after it happened. Now, who knows if he was coached or coerced by the state, or maybe by his own family. After all, Gregory Artis was his relative. It's even possible that the memory was so painful that dissociative amnesia took over. Either way, the jury didn't hear what we all know he had said right after he saw his uncle and mother fatally shot. Instead, the state pieced together coerced or incentivized witness statements. People with no knowledge of the crime. That's the state's case. That's it. Floating on the hope that the jury might think, well, yeah, they can't all be lying. And I understand the Commonwealth attorney did something that showed that they knew. You tell me what you think, but it seems like they knew how fraudulent this prosecution was. They passed a plea deal to your attorney, Dwayne Struthers, even after all this.
After the Commonwealth presented their case, they asked him, would I be willing to plead to second-degree murder? And again, I asked him, like, you know, how much time did this occur? And from his actions, you know, the way he looked at me, he wanted me to gamble with the jury. I've already had been convicted once, and I knew it was a possibility that, you know, I could get life in prison again.
And your attorney didn't properly advise you about this, but second-degree murder carries a sentence of 5 to 40 years, not life, not in Virginia.
And I refused it. And here I am, sinned again. You know, I get convicted again and I ended up with life.
I mean, it must have felt like deja vu all over again.
It definitely did. I'm like, this can't be happening like a second time. It's like, I just felt like defeated. And I know this time my fight would be a whole lot harder. It's very rare that you see anybody get 3 trials. Being convicted a second time, it was hard. Going back to Walnut Ridge, I just can remember the ride that I had when my first trial was overturned and they turned me back to the jail. I was in tears for real because of the prison conditions and all the people that I'm going to leave behind. Like, I would never see this again. Guys don't get this opportunity I'm about to get. And like I said, the whole ride back to that jail, I was in tears. I was like, this is a chapter of my life that's over with. And it didn't happen that way.
In 2020, a group of young women in a tidy suburb of New York City found themselves in an AI-fueled nightmare.
Someone was posting photos.
It was just me naked. Well, not me, but me with someone else's body parts on my body parts that looked exactly like my own.
I wanted to throw up. I wanted to scream.
It happened in Levittown, New York.
But reporting the series took us through the darkest corners of the internet. and to the front lines of a global battle against deepfake pornography.
This should be illegal, but what is this?
This is a story about a technology that's moving faster than the law and about vigilantes trying to stem the tide. I'm Margie Murphy.
And I'm Olivia Carvel.
This is Levittown, a new podcast from iHeart Podcasts, Bloomberg and Kaleidoscope.
Listen to Levittown on Bloomberg's Big Take podcast. Find it on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In 1978, Roger Caron's first book was published, and he was unlike any first-time author Canada had ever seen.
Roger Caron was 16 when first convicted.
Has spent 24 of those years in jail.
12 years in solitary.
He went from an ex-con to a literary darling almost overnight.
He was instantly a celebrity.
He was an adrenaline junkie, and he was the star of the show.
Go Boy is the gritty true story of how one man fought his way out of some of the darkest places imaginable.
I had a knife go in my stomach, puncture my spleen, break my rib, I had my guts all in my hands.
Only to find himself back where he started.
Roger's saying is, I've never hurt anybody but myself. And I said, oh, you're so wrong. You're so wrong on that one, Rob.
From Campside Media and iHeart Podcasts, listen to Go Boy on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, hello, Malcolm Gladwell here. On this season of Revisionist History, we're going where no podcast has ever gone before. In combination with my three-year-old, we defend the show that everyone else hates. I'm talking, of course, about Paw Patrol.
There's some things that really piss me off when it comes to Paw Patrol.
It's pretty simple. It sucks.
My son watches Paw Patrol. I hate it.
Everyone hates it, except for me. Plus, we investigate everything from why American sirens are so unbearably loud, to the impact of face blindness on social connection, to the secret behind Thomas's English muffins, perfect nooks and crannies. And also, we go after Joe Rogan. Are you ready, Joe? I'm coming for you. You won't want to miss it. Listen to Revisionist History on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, me being convicted the second time, I knew my fight would be, you know, a whole lot harder. Of course, I went through the litigation process, and my family later on down the line, you know, put out more money for me trying to get me out. I just always try to be positive and keep that hope, like one day, like justice will prevail and I will be able to, you know, walk out these prison doors.
That return trip to prison was February 2003. It's now February 2023, and you're still there. But like you said, the fight is not over. Your first attempt was for ineffective assistance of counsel.
Dwayne Struthers, he had a series of, like, disciplinary actions from the state bar, like, in 2003. Then his license was suspended for 2 years in 2006 because, you know, he failed to, you know, communicate with his clients and, you know, he didn't pursue cases diligently. So I was hoping when I filed this habeas claim against him that they would overturn my case just based on the lack of competence of Dwayne Struthers. And I did get the evidentiary hearing on Struthers' incompetency because of them offered me the plea bargain for second-degree murder and he didn't know how much time that occurred. The district court granted to hear my issue on that claim back in 2008. But the thing where I didn't get any relief on that issue is because, you know, the Commonwealth attorney, Philip Ferguson, the head Commonwealth attorney in Suffolk at that time, he testified that in Suffolk, he has a policy that all plea bargains must be reviewed and signed by him. And he wasn't going to give the authorization. So that's why the judge, he didn't rule in my favor.
And so that rendered the point moot. Not that there aren't plenty of other points to raise about ineffective assistance, because at the second trial, he did not point out that the only witness to the murder, young Trayvon, did not point you out in court. It seems like seeing you in court should have jarred something loose if you, in fact, had killed his mother. But you didn't. And once again, the fact that none of the fingerprints taken from the scene that they felt were probative, none of them were a match for you, because you weren't there. But this was not raised, as was the fact that the fingerprints have never been tested against Gregory Artis, which is insane. So, Lenny, I know you've been on this case since your release brought you to the Western branch of the John A. Cogshill Law Firm. And in another stunning, awful setback for this case, Attorney Cogshill, a legend in the innocence community and a friend, to me and you guys and so many others, passed away suddenly in June 2022. May he rest in peace. So where does that leave Lirico's case?
So once again, the law firm of John A. Cogshill filed Lirico's petition on January 5th, 2022 to the Secretary of Commonwealth Office. That petition primarily dealt with the statements made by Trayvon Artis the day of the murders and the following day when they interviewed him again. Of course, we know there was no physical evidence that pointed to Lirico Kearney's guilt and that Trayvon Artis definitively told the detectives who killed his mom and uncle. That was the foundation upon which this petition was established, along with the convicted felons who came forward with false testimony in order to get deals. And fortunately, we were able to get an affidavit from Mr. Travis Chalk, who said he just wanted to clear his conscience, and he came forward and said it was all a lie. Everything he said was a lie. He didn't see Lirico Kearney with a gun. He didn't see Lirico Kearney following Gene Artis. He was told exactly what to say by this detective when he went to court, and he said as much in the affidavit.
The petition also details everything you've heard here, the inconsistencies and contradictions between the false witnesses and between the statements and the facts of the crime. So what does the petition seek?
A conditional pardon on behalf of Lirico Kearney. His petition is awaiting review because of the long list of people who have filed before him. From what we've been told, they're so swamped that it's going to be a long process. So we're hoping to get as much airplay as possible for Mr. Kearney to hopefully change this wrongful conviction.
Well, you have all of our support, and hopefully our audience will lend a hand as well. There's currently a petition alerting the governor of this wrongful conviction, pleading for his team to take notice of the grave injustice that this is. So please do it right now. Click the link in the episode bio and get involved. And now we go to my favorite part of the show. It's called, of course, Closing Arguments, where I first of all thank you guys for being here and sharing this harrowing story. And then I'm going to turn my microphone off, leave my headphones on, kick back in my chair, and just listen to any closing thoughts you may have. So let's kick it off with Lenny and then close it out with you, Lirico.
Once again, we have a case where the only evidence that the Commonwealth has in a double murder is convicted felons. It's a sad state of affairs when we are putting people away for life based on convicted felons getting deals. It's time for us to do something, especially in the Commonwealth of Virginia. It's time for prosecutors to bear some of this weight for using convicted felons that they know have extensive criminal records and they know they're getting deals. It's time for the prosecution to possibly suffer as a result of this. I mean, it's the only way that I can see that this situation will ever change. It's a sad day that somebody like Lirico Kearney has been in the prison system for 25 years or more for something he did not do. There is no evidence to support it. It's time for this to change.
I mean, I would just like to say thank y'all for allowing me the opportunity to share my story with the world. Again, this is a situation that anybody can find themselves in. Anybody can come forward and just say you said anything. It's not right without the supporting evidence, but 25 plus years in prison, you know, I'm still healthy. I still have hope that someday, you know, the justice will prevail and I will be able to walk out of this prison and be with the people that love me, try to build, you know, a relationship with my children. I would like to see my daughter walk down the aisle. And like I said, I just wanted to, you know, just go out there and just be a pillar to my community and try to help others that may be lost so they won't end up in the same position that I'm in. Again, I just express my condolences to, you know, the Artis family, what they have went through. You know, nobody deserved to die, but I shouldn't spend the rest of my life in prison based on, you know, people trying to help their own situations. And I'm just looking forward to the day, like I said, I'm released, and I feel in my heart that, you know, justice will prevail and the right thing will be done. You know, my heart and my courage, I'm just, you know, too big just to die in prison.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall, Jeff Clyburn, and Kevin Wardis, with research by Lila Robinson.
The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction, on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast, and on Twitter at Wrong Conviction, as well as at Lava for Good on all 3 platforms. You can also follow me on both TikTok and Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.
Clayton English.
I'm Greg Glott.
And this is season 2 of the War on Drugs podcast.
Sir, last year, a lot of the problems of the drug war. This year, a lot of the biggest names in music and sports.
This is kind of star-studded a little bit, man.
We met them at their homes. We met them at their recording studios. Stories matter, and it brings a face to it.
It makes it real.
It really does. It makes it real.
Listen to new episodes of the War on Drugs podcast season 2 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Michael Kasson, founder and CEO of 3C Ventures and your guide on Good Company, the podcast where I sit down with the boldest innovators shaping what's next. In this episode, I'm joined by Anjali Sood, CEO of Tubi. We dive into the competitive world of streaming.
What others dismiss as niche, we embrace as core. There's so many stories out there, and if you can find a way to curate and help the right person discover the right content, the term that we always hear from our audience is that they feel seen.
Listen to Good Company on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Brendan Patrick Hughes, host of Divine Intervention. This is a story about radical nuns in combat boots and wild-haired priests trading blows with J. Edgar Hoover in a hell-bent effort to sabotage a war.
J. Edgar Hoover was furious. He was out of his mind, and he wanted to bring the Catholic left to its knees.
Listen to Divine Intervention on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.